Now, I teach this across the country, so a lot of this will seems kind of silly, because in South Carolina we have certain rules that we have to follow to get somebody licensed. Other states do not. Other states finish polygraph school and they just go to work. Right? There's no internship, there's no test, there's no nothing. They just go back to their agency on Monday and they are now the polygraph examiner. Right? So we obviously do things a little differently. So when you see some of these slides, it's a little bit more generic towards all states versus just South Carolina. But when we intern people, it's an interesting thing to watch somebody come out of polygraph school. We were all there once, where our first couple of tests are pretty clunky. We get a little better as we go, and then by the time we get around 150, we're starting to do a lot better without any input from whoever our sponsor is. And it seems like on the front end, you're never going to get there. That 150 seems like it's going to take forever, but you get there. And then by the time you're around 150, you're asking a whole lot less questions, and you are able to come up with your test question construction on your own. Your TDA is starting to look pretty good. Your score sheets don't have as many scratches all over them. You're not having to redo score sheets. Your mistakes that you make mid-chart start to be less and less, or you get your questions out of order, or if you get chart notations, those things start getting better and better. But think about states that don't do any of that. You just graduate from polygraph school on Friday, Monday you are it. And your chief or sheriff says, I've got a pile of people for you to get through, and there's been no internship, you're a one-man shop, you don't have anybody to kind of lean on. It can be pretty overwhelming. I can only imagine if I didn't have the help of people training me when I got out of polygraph school, what that would look like. And then the amount of bad habits that we probably all would have fallen into without a little guidance. So when we travel around the country, we do talk a little bit about training new examiners, and this is a pretty short slide deck, but I do think it's important for us to talk about, because everybody in here, either if you're not already, you will at some point train a new examiner. And it's going to be difficult, more difficult for some than others. Some people will get it, pick it up real easy, it's going to be no problem. Some people are going to need maybe more than 150 tests. And so when we evaluate that, we need to kind of to know about what our state does. Now in South Carolina, obviously we know what our state laws are. We have, everybody here is South Carolina. Everybody here is a North Carolina person today. We have to do our 150, right? It used to be 200. And so how long has it been 150?
Yeah.
Probably 15, 18 years it's been 150, right?
Yeah, actually I was there when they changed it.
20 years?
Mine was 20 years ago and I had to do 150.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
It was when they first started escaping in, Willis Burns, who I was mentoring, talked to Skip Mitchell.
Yes.
He changed it to 150 from 200.
Yeah.
The lieutenant before Dennis.
Yeah.
Yes.
So however long that was.
Yeah.
So and there's, even in the federal government, most of those guys get 25. Most of those guys get 25. Now they get 50 before they leave school, so it's a little different. They're getting a grand total of 75. And they have a much more stringent oversight with peer review and multiple levels of peer review. In the federal government, you go through like three levels of peer review before they call a test, and then DI or NDI or NSR or SR. Obviously, we know what it looks like in our state. We know what our minimum tests are. We take a board examination. A lot of states don't do that, which I think is a great tool here. Now, some states are more strict than us. Some states have training requirements or more steps they have to do. In Tennessee, you have to go in front of a board. It's not just Tennessee Bureau of Investigations deciding whether or not you get a polygraph license. You go in front of a board, and they have people from all over the state, from multiple agencies, and that board unanimously decides whether or not that person gets a license or not. And I think Tennessee might be 100 or 150 tests too, I'm not sure. I know they have a minimum number. Does your agency have a policy on how new examiners are trained? Probably not, right? Now, if you're with PLE, we do have that in an SOP already ready to go. So I'd love for some of you guys to reach out to me here after this and talk about what you'd want to do to get into PLE. But yeah, we would have a policy set for that, where what that looks like, or at least an SOP. We have rigid FTO programs at our agencies. Why as a polygraph community do we not have a kind of a shared SOP that we use to train new examiners? It's a good question, because we're all doing different stuff, right? Everybody has different formats they use and different TDA they use, and chiefs and sheriffs have different priorities. I don't think it'd be a bad idea for your agency to come up with a field training program for training new examiners, what that's going to look like. How many tests you should run like this, how many should be PLCs, how many should be DLCs. Just something to think about. All right, do new examiners fresh out of school even need training?
Yes.
Yes.
Of course. Of course. It's just like the academy. You get out of the academy, you know the minimum, right? You know the very bare minimum to get by and to take a call for service. You probably sound stupid when you're talking to your victims and your complainants on the front end. They don't know that. They think whatever you're saying is probably right. But yeah, of course, you need an FTO. You need to have some training. School is doing the minimum, especially with schools now are getting shorter and shorter and faster. The academy is doing the same thing, right? First 4 weeks is now online, and the last 8 weeks is in person. So there's a lot of pressure to churn people out, especially in private schools. Very few of us have had the opportunity to go to a government polygraph school where they're 14 or 16 weeks. Over at NCTC, I think is 16 weeks up in Pennsylvania, or NCCA, which I think is still 14 weeks. Most of us did Atlanta, where it was 8 or 10 or 12 weeks, whatever it was, and kick us out, ready for the next group, right? And it's kind of just getting us through. Do polygraph schools need to do more? Do we need to have more senior examiner schools to fill in? I think it's a great idea for new examiners within a year of getting out of polygraph school to go to one of the senior examiner schools that we teach through PLEA. And we go back through TDA. And now that you know what charts look like, and now that you've spent a year running tests, you've got a little bit better an idea of what we're talking about. When we talk about cut scores and post-test and how long should a post-test last and things like that, which polygraph school doesn't necessarily teach us all that. It doesn't teach interview interrogation. It doesn't teach how to talk to people. It doesn't teach how to go through a booklet. You go through your application questionnaire. It doesn't teach you how to do appeals and how many times you should ask somebody, are you sure you've never used any marijuana? Have you ever touched it with your finger? Right? And those are all things that we kind of pick up over time to get admissions from people during the pretest. Keeping a suspect in the chair. That's something tough to do sometimes, right? We have a suspect come in to take a test, and you have a new examiner that's looking at a defiant suspect who is difficult, and we're trying to keep them in the chair, trying to run the test, and the suspect is saying, I just want to go home, I don't want to do this, what are you asking me all these questions for? It's difficult, and you have to learn how to navigate that, and that's something that senior examiner schools sometimes can help fill the gap on that. Are program managers pressuring schools to churn out examiners? Probably not at our level. We don't have any huge polygraph programs here in South Carolina. But there are some big polygraph programs out there. You look at places like LAPD and TBI and Virginia State Police and Florida State Patrol and GBI and some of these that have 10 and 15 and 18 and 20 examiners. They're sending probably a person or two a year, three a year to school. And so those program managers have probably got speed dial for the Atlanta school and the Florida school and NCTC and all those guys are on speed dial. Hey, I need some slots, and I need to make sure my people get in, and we need to hurry up and get them out. I don't want to do the extra time. I don't want to do the extra 2 weeks or the extra week or whatever it is. Just do the bare minimum and get them back to me. And that doesn't do us any good, right? So pressuring schools to turn out examiners faster with a lower fail rate. Did anybody fail any polygraph schools in your classes? Yeah. You had one? Mm-hmm. Maybe one? Yeah, I know at NCCA they fail them a lot because those slots get opened back up to other people. They have people on standby waiting to fill slots for people that fail. I had one or two fail, but it just surprised me as difficult as some of that stuff was to get through, how many people passed. It just seemed like there was maybe a little curve going on there to make sure that people get through kind of no matter what. All right. Selecting new examiners. When we select examiners, does it matter what their background kind of looks like in law enforcement? If you pick somebody off the road who's been on the road for 2 years and send them to polygraph school, and they're in a pretty small jurisdiction where they might take 4 or 5 calls a day, maybe, has that person got an advantage over somebody who's been in investigations for 10 years and has done thousands of interviews and interrogations, and maybe has done some background investigations on the side as a side gig with their agency. There's going to be a huge talent difference in those two people going to polygraph school. I'm not saying that your patrolman, who's only worked 2 years, wouldn't make a good polygraph examiner. I'm just saying they are at a disadvantage from somebody who can interrogate, somebody who's worked burglaries and CSEs and robberies and all the things that we do tests on. It's one thing to run a test on somebody who has committed a CSE and you've never worked the case before, versus I've worked 100 CSEs and I've interrogated half of those people and arrested tons of CSC suspects. You know how to talk to them. You know what the case law looks like. You know what the statutes look like. You have them all memorized. You've worked burglaries for years. You know what burglars' behaviors are like. You know what an addict's kind of daily routine might look like. Those are all things that, if you've worked cases for a long time, makes it a little easier on you versus somebody who's never worked any cases before. So if you don't already have some selection criteria as to who goes to school next, maybe you should. Something to think about, right? When you do an oral board, what are they, are they trying to get off the road? Are they just trying to get a 9-to-5? Are they trying to get polygraph certified so they can go over to the Highway Patrol or somewhere else and be an examiner over there? Are they trying to escape your agency? So, I do think some candidates have advantages over others. I mean, I just do. I think most of us in here probably worked some cases, worked the road for a little while, kind of did a little bit of everything, maybe did some internal cases before. And so you've had a little bit of experience before you go to polygraph school. How do we pick the school the examiner will attend? We kind of go with what's available, right? If you happen to line up with the polygraph school up in Pennsylvania, the NCTC school, which only runs like one or two a year, it's a great school to go to. It's a government school. NCCA, it's tough to get in right now. Doesn't look like they're going to let local examiners in for a while, although there's some talk about it. We may be able to work our way back into there at some point. But right now, they're not letting local examiners go. And you've got a school in Florida. You've got Pam Shaw School. You've got a school in Atlanta. And then there's some schools on the west side of the country. And they teach totally different stuff than what you and I have been talking about today. So it may be difficult to send somebody to school on the West Coast and then come back to the East Coast and try to run tests. You're probably going to have to totally start over with their training. There's still some Baxter-type schools out there. All right. Does polygraph create a stalled upward promotional scenario? It can. I sat as a polygraph examiner for 16 years without getting promoted. Because if they promote you, they're going to promote you out, right? Or they're going to give you a unit. You're going to have to do polygraph and run a unit. And depending on the size of your agency, that's tough. And I know everybody has different size groups that come from. I run about 150 tests or so a year. I don't have time to manage a unit, right? There's no way I could manage a unit or work cases and run polygraphs, because that's almost one a day for me every day, short of days off and training and things like that. So it can. You know, when you're trying to advertise inside of your agency, hey, why don't you go to polygraph school? Like, oh, great, that sounds great. What's the promotional system look like inside of polygraph? Unless you're Brian Godfrey and you can get promoted 19 times inside of polygraph, which he did, and stayed in polygraph.
Smart.
Right. That's hard to do. I have an interview interrogation class that I teach, and I have two or three of his videos in there. And about every 6 months, I'd have to go back and change his rank in my slideshow, because it went from investigator, sergeant, lieutenant, to captain, to what was it after that?
They made up a rank.
They made up, it was, yeah. But you did major, were you major first?
I'm major.
Major, and then they made up a rank.
Yeah, lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel. Yeah. And so I had to change it from investigator all the way to lieutenant colonel, and he never left polygraph. And so that's probably a unicorn. That probably doesn't happen much. But then you had another examiner. You were able to do other stuff. And so if somebody's there, they're going to replace you eventually. But most of our agencies aren't big enough to have two or three full-time examiners, and that's all they do is polygraph. I am lucky enough that's all I do is polygraph. I don't do anything else. But it can create some upward promotional situations where you kind of get stuck. And you get stuck in polygraph for 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 years. And if you want to get out, you got to get somebody else in, get them trained, and then you can put in for a promotion somewhere else. And so sometimes that can be a hard sell. That can be tough. Do we want a high turnover in polygraph?
No.
No, we do not want to incentivize somebody coming to polygraph for 2 or 3 years and then moving on. 2 or 3 years, you're just starting to figure out what you're supposed to be doing, right? Just like on the road in Colombia, we say about 5 year mark, you're starting to kind of know what you're doing on the road. You're starting to train other officers. You're starting to not sound like an idiot in court. You're starting to be able to make better cases. So we don't want a high turnover at all. In the federal government, they compensate their polygraph examiners well to keep them in place, right? $130,000, $140,000 to start some of those jobs on the federal side, and they want to keep them there. And they'll just keep promoting them in place and leave them right where they are. And then they dangle the hot dog out in front of you, their carrot in front of you. One day you'll end up at NCCA as an instructor in good old Columbia, South Carolina, and that'll be kind of your route that you go. So they always want to keep people in place. It is tough. We don't want a high turnover. Examiners get promoted in place. So if you're with a big program, sure. If you're with LAPD and they have like 4 levels of supervision inside of their polygraph program, where a QC is one level and the QC has a QC and then a program manager. And so, sure, if there's 15, 18 people inside your polygraph program, there's a lot of room for getting promoted. Most of us are 1 and 2 man shops. We're going to be polygraph examiners, investigators, detectives, sergeants, probably for the big chunk of our careers. Sometimes that's okay. It's a good job. All right, day one out of polygraph school, examiners know what a polygraph school taught them, right? And they typically, if you've noticed this, like what their school sells them. So if you run Lafayette or you run Oxiton and they ran the opposite in polygraph school, they're going to come back and say, well, this sucks. We ran Oxiton in polygraph school, it's so much better. We ran Lafayette in polygraph school, it's so much better. And they want to swap, right? And so sometimes you have to tell them on the way in, we run Lafayette. I don't care what you run in polygraph school. When you come back here, we're going to run Lafayette or vice versa. And so they'll like DLCs. Why do new students like DLCs? Yeah. It's easy. Right? You know, manipulation. You don't have to be good. I could teach my 20-year-old son how to run a DLC in probably 20 minutes. To run a PLC, it takes some finesse, right? You have to kind of mess with people's heads a little bit. And it does take a little bit of a, it takes some years to kind of get that under your belt. Where you can sell a PLC to somebody until you see them start to squirm in the chair and then you move on from it. Like, I got you, I see you're squirming, let's move on from it, right? You'll learn about what a PLC is soon enough. I don't let any new examiners run DLCs on anything. They have to run PLCs all the time. Because I can let you run about 5 DLCs and you've got it. We don't need to run a whole bunch of them. I'm gonna make you run 145, probably PLCs, on your exams. So if you're training new people, just consider that. Consider how easy a DLC is and how much more difficult a PLC is, and make them run PLCs during your examination. So when you're doing your screening, you're doing things like that. Now, of course, DLCs are not authorized for criminal tests. You never use a DLC on a criminal test. That has a completely different mindset to it. They are not authorized for criminal testing. We can talk about that if everybody wants to. But PLCs only on criminal tests. But on an applicant screening test, you can run a DLC, right? So I would suggest doing that only during training. Just because a school teaches a brand new fancy thing, does that mean we should just pick it up and start using it? I'm gonna tell you, the tri-state down in Georgia, do y'all remember the tri-state in Georgia? We did maybe, has that been 5 or 6 years ago? We did it at Tybee. Mm-hmm. It was in Tybee. Mm-hmm. And we had an examiner from like San Francisco Police Department or something?
Yep.
San Diego. He was talking about some wild stuff.
Yes,
he was just making stuff up, and he was saying that NCCA teaches it, and this is mainstream stuff, and everybody ought to be doing it. You know what everybody in the classroom was doing? Oh, that sounds great. Wrote all that stuff down. You know what they did on Monday when they got back to work? Implemented it. You know what they do with the new examiners that are coming in now? Teach them that nonsense, right? And that stuff can take hold. And before you know it, what does John Adams say? It's the drift. Polygraph drift. Have y'all ever heard John Adams talk about polygraph drift? It's where you just, you drift off course just a little bit, and then the next 6 months you drift a little bit more, and then 6 months from now you drift a little bit more, and then when someone calls you out on it and says, why are you doing this? And you go, I don't know. I've been doing this for years. And you don't realize how far you've gotten from what you learned until you look backwards and say, man, I got there 1 inch at a time. A little bit here, a little bit here, a little bit there. Cut this corner, or cut that corner. And the polygraph drift sets in. But that dude was talking about some wild stuff. He was talking about dropping certain questions, rotating by zone 5 and 7. He was talking about, you know, no more symptomatics. Everything should be scored like a by zone. MGQT should be scored like a by zone. I mean, just all kinds of stuff. Now, is all that going to come true one day? Maybe. It might. But until somebody runs about 200,000 or 300,000 tests like that and has a good body of research, none of us should just jump on something that we hear in an APA or an AAPP or something like that. We ought to make sure it comes from a legitimate source, right? Not somebody's garage where they looked at a couple hundred tests and said, yeah, this looks good. We're just going to start doing it, right?
Yeah, it was so weird. It made me drink at night.
It was strange. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You had to go down to Savannah and have a couple drinks. Yeah, it was strange. I was texting Rusty Manley in the middle of that class going, this can't be true, right? And he was like, it is not true. I said, okay, all right. Is your program using best practices? Now, getting back to certain things, does it take NCCA a long time to sign on stuff? Sometimes. Sometimes it does, right? And I'm okay with that because I want to be sure before I start implementing it that it's right, right? Took them a long time to jump onto kind of their version of federal ESS. That's okay. ESS had been around in various versions for about 10 years prior to that, 15 years prior to that. There's a lot of versions floating around out there. But it took them a long time to kind of narrow that down into what they were going to use. I'm all right with that. I want to make sure when I use something, it's been fully tested hundreds of thousands of times. Is your program using the best practices? Are you using the most accurate format for your screening, for your criminal test? Depends, right? Depends on the school. Schools are pushing DLST a lot, right? I've seen where people are starting to run criminal exams using DLST, using a DLC. That's a no-go. We're not using DLCs to do criminal exams. We're not using DLSTs for criminal exams. It's literally in the name of the test. Directed lie screening test, not specific issue test, right? Okay, so let's stick with the best practices. Even when your new examiner comes out of school and has the latest and greatest thing, they want to tell you about this cap you put on your head, and you know, can tell the truth whether you're telling the truth or not. Let's just stick with our components that we have that are approved for now. And as something else comes out that is comes from the federal government or comes from a body of research that we can trust a little better, we can adjust from there. All right, day one. We're gonna let maybe the examiner let you run one and they watch on the first day, maybe, right? Typically that's what I do. They come to me on the first day, I say, hey, watch me run one. That way you can see how I apply consent, how we set up the room, where I have the person sit, how I go through the booklet, if it's an applicant test, how I talk to suspects, if it's a suspect test, how I apply Miranda, how I put on the chart, the components, they can watch that on the screen, take a bunch of notes. Just like on day one FTO, it's been a long time since I was an FTO, typically the FTO drives. Are they still doing that with your agencies? FTO typically drives on the first day. The new person is a passenger on day one. That's the only day they get to be a passenger, is that first day. I don't disagree with that. Maybe letting them watch you run one, maybe one criminal and one applicant test, or just one test period. All right. Familiarize the examiner with everything, your forms, how your reports are going to be written. If you're going to write a detailed polygraph report, and I think that matters. We talk a lot about that kind of in plea. Well, how much do you put in your polygraph reports? Well, it depends. Does background go first or do you go first? If background goes first and there's already a report out there that says the education, the degrees, their marriage, their kids, their address, the type of car they drive, all those things are already in report, then maybe you don't copy that over into yours. It's kind of the same thing. But if you go before backgrounds, then maybe they want more of that in the report. And so those are going to be things we have to talk to the examiner about, especially if they're going to intern in multiple places. Noah's going to intern with me a good bit, and he's going to intern at SLED. Now, we don't do, our reports are not terribly different, so it's pretty easy for him to write polygraph reports in both places. It's not going to be terribly different. But your agency may want a ton more or less information in the polygraph reports and the forms that you use. So make sure you give them a good opportunity. Don't expect that they came out of school with the same consent form that you have, and they're going to read it the same way that you want it to be read, or they're going to go through suitability the way that you want them to go through it. So we'll talk a little bit about approved formats. They may come out of school knowing Utah or some other West Coast format that we've never heard of, a Cleve-Baxter zone or something that they're going to want to run. And you're probably going to have to narrow it down to what you already run and what you're familiar with, zones, bisons, and MGQT. It's probably going to be our bread and butter for criminal tests. Pretest. Make sure that you tell them all the things that you want covered. And you have to get little things like make sure their cell phone is not in the room with them or turned all the way off. Make sure they show up well-rested. Make sure they show up and eat breakfast if they're applicants and you can control some of those things. Make sure you cover a lot of those things with the new examiner because they're not going to think about that. They assume that when this person shows up in the room, someone else has already done all that. Someone else has already told them to turn their phone off, to make sure they're parked in the right place, make sure they fed the meter. They've got all the things they need to be ready to go. And there's nothing like when the examinee comes and sits down in the first 30 seconds and says, hey man, I'm parked in the meter, I've only got 30 minutes. And you go, we gotta stop what we're doing, go move your car to another spot, whatever it is. We gotta go over all that stuff with your new examiner, especially if they're intern from another agency. In-test, correct operations, quality charts. We don't wanna run garbage charts. That is probably my biggest thing that I do when I'm training a new examiner is get good quality charts. Now, we can't always control everything, but we can control a ton of stuff as it relates to good quality charts. Post-test, what's an acceptable post-test? You have to set that boundary. Because if you don't, it'll be 30 seconds. They'll go DI, SR, your new examiner will go in there and say, hey man, you had some trouble in the test, and the bad guy's gonna say, I didn't do it. So you go, all right, well, see you later. And you're gonna have to catch them, be like, whoa, wait a minute. That wasn't long enough. So I would recommend you give them a time amount. SR on an applicant, 20, 30 minutes. That should be the standard minimum if they go SR. Don't come out of the room for 20 or 30 minutes. Or wait for me to text you and I tell you you've had enough. They're not going to say anything. But if you don't say anything, they'll give that applicant 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and they'll be done on a post-test. On a suspect, when do we come out of the room on a suspect? Confession or lay lawyer up. Other than that, keep on keeping on, right? If you need to get in there and tag team them after they've been in there for an hour or two, they're running out of material, fine, no problem. But all that should be discussed with your new examiner pretty early on, and I would highly recommend that you set a post-test time amount, minimum time amount, especially on applicants, because they 5 minutes and they're out. I can't get them to confess to anything. All right, report writing, talk a little bit about that. QC expectations. So with new examiners, you want to, if you print charts, great. If you don't, that's fine too. You should go over every chart, every scoring spot, every comparison, every relevant, and justify each number they put on the score sheet. If they put a plus on a pneumo, that's fine. Show it to me. Let me see what plus you're using. Why did you plus? Which one did you plus? I've noticed that a lot of people, when they come out of school, on their score sheets for pneumos will just put a plus or a minus in the pneumo box. Was that the top pneumo or the bottom pneumo? So there should be a top pneumo and a bottom pneumo score, right, so that I know which is which. There should be a way that they could look at that and tell me which pneumo they chose, whether it was the top or the bottom or both. All right, so we'll do that during TDA. But if you want to print charts, that is easier for new examiners because you can just spread them out on the table, look right on them, you can make notes on them, you can do whatever you want to do, so because it's a training chart. And you can really go through each chart and justify each number that you put on the chart. Polygraph file creation, whether it's going to be digital or paper, it doesn't matter. They need to learn how to do that. Everybody in here, evidence.com, most people are evidence.com. You have an unlimited cloud storage. You should be able to scan everything in if you want to, or you create a file, but that file should be an organized file with a beginning and an end. Maybe a cover sheet, maybe a polygraph report, copy of the consent form, copy of your booklet, copy of the test questions. APA says you have to be able to recreate the test without using the charts. So you should be able to recreate most of your test, even if I didn't have the charts with me, right? I should be able to know what format was used, the cut scores that were used, the scoring format that we used, and I should be able to have a report that tells me whether they passed or failed, how they did, any admissions that were made. All that should be recreated without looking at the charts. So you should have enough stuff in your polygraph file where if I sent it to somebody else, they would look at it and go, okay, this is an applicant, here's a consent form, here's some suitability questions that we asked. They're suitable to take the test. We asked them if they were intoxicated or not feeling well, if they've had some breakfast, if they had some sleep last night. We've asked them some of those questions. We determined they were fit to take an exam. And we wrote that somewhere on our suitability section. All right. PLCs versus DLCs change how the pretest is set up for screening, right? A DLC, you only review at the very end, right as you're doing an ACQT. You don't even talk about the DLC until the very, very end. On a PLC, you kind of hit them right off the bat, kind of as soon as you get out of your consent, and you explain some of the things you need to explain. Now we're going to talk about honesty and integrity on a screening test, right? We'll make sure you're an honest person, not the type of person that lies. And so that will change your entire format on the setup of your test. I talked about this earlier, no DLC for criminal exams, obviously screening only. Review do's and don'ts with your trainee if there are just things that you absolutely don't want your trainee to do. So if somebody does not confess, or they give them 5 minutes of post-test interrogation or post-test interview if it's a suspect, screening test, you may tell them, hey, don't walk them out until I come and get you, right? I'll decide when they get to walk out, or I'll decide when it's over, or I need to talk to the applicant before they leave. If they don't, if your trainee doesn't work for your agency and there's some things that you need to tell the applicant before they leave, make sure that they leave the person in the chair, come get you, say, hey, I've done all I can do, you can talk to them. But if those are instructions that you need to do, make sure your trainee knows that. I know at our agency, I don't like our examinees. Our polygraph is assigned to investigations with Columbia. And so in the investigative division, one of our floors, the whole floor of headquarters is part of our investigative division. And when I let the examinee go use the bathroom, I don't just open the door and say, go down this hall, make a right, go to the next hall, make a left, like we walk with them to the bathroom. And so you need to tell your new examiner that, hey, walk with them to the bathroom so they don't get lost. And tell them to sit in the lobby until you're ready to come back and get them on their break. If you don't, your examiner may just open the door and say, hey, bathroom's down the hall, and then they just go get lost, right? And so all those things you need to review do's and don'ts with your trainee. Pretest. Screening test should conduct a full booklet review. I've trained examiners before that just kind of go through the booklet real quick. You know, they don't go through every single question on the booklet. Hey, got any jobs you didn't list? Okay, get to drugs. Oh, are there any drugs you haven't used, you hadn't told us about? Okay, get to driving record. Are there any tickets you didn't tell us about? And about 10 minutes later, they're done with the booklet. That's probably not ideal. Probably want to go through every single question in your booklet or your application questionnaire or your application. Go through the whole thing, every single question. Criminal tests should conduct a full insert review. If they have an insert report to go through, even if they already know the case facts on the criminal test, they should sit there in the pretest and go through the whole thing with the examinee. That way the examinee has an opportunity either to confess pretest or to fully talk about the incident that they're about to get tested on, so there's no confusion. How many times have you done a criminal test where you get to the topic at hand and nobody has ever asked the suspect if they did it? And that's the very first time anybody has ever asked the suspect if they did the bad thing. I've had pretest confessions like that many times. And I go, well, so you stole the money? And I go, yeah. I'm like, well, why didn't you tell the investigator? Never asked me if I stole the money. Not one time was I ever asked if I stole the money. So at least give them the opportunity to ask the bad guy if they did the bad thing, if it's a criminal test. All right, test question construction should be a group effort for a little while. Maybe the first 50, 75 tests, you should be going over every test question construction scenario with them. Even if it's a CSC, you've already done 5 CSCs, and we're doing another CSC that's about the same. Of course, we're gonna copy that over. It's gonna be pretty close, but we may adjust it slightly. Look at our comparisons, make sure our comparisons are good. We're not coming up with any wild comparisons or anything like that. Make sure that we're doing time bars or separated by scope. We talk about all those things. So test question construction should be a group effort for a while. I still do test question construction as a group effort. I will still call other examiners and say, hey, listen to this. What do you think? Brian and I talk probably at least once or twice a month on test question construction on various cases coming up. And sometimes we just have to hang up the phone and say, oh, no, I'll call you tomorrow. Let me think about it. I'll call you tomorrow. And then I'll have an epiphany in the middle of the night and say, this is what it sounds like to me. And so we'll do that on a regular basis. We should all be doing that all the time. I talk to John pretty regularly about cases coming up. Limit DLCs for new examiners. We talk about that. My opinion is no DLCs, just a few here and there, just so they know how to do it. But do PLCs for new examiners on screening. No DLCs for criminal tests. Can't say that enough. All right, what is our number one goal for chart collection?
Good data.
That's it. We want to get quality charts. Quality charts. Train examiners to stop the charts if they are poor quality. Do not just keep going through the chart if it is garbage. Irrelevant, sacrifice relevant, symptomatic, comparison on a buy zone. If it's not right at that point, that's 4 questions. If it's not right at that point, you're 2 minutes in, minute 45 seconds in, stop. It is not just gonna magically get better. Stop the chart and do something. Give them an instruction, change the cardio cuff from the forearm to the upper arm, back and forth. Move the EDA plates to another hand, use an alcohol wipe, wipe the fingers off, tell them to cut it out if they're participating in shenanigans, give them some instructions, train examiners to stop the charts. How do we get good quality charts every time? We control all variables. Everything that you can control, you control those variables. What can we control? We can make the appointment personally. I make every appointment personally. I call every person on the phone, especially if it's an applicant, and make the appointment. I tell them what to wear, where to park, get a good night's sleep, take your medications, or don't, whatever it is. Don't come in here and drink C4s right before you come in. If you're gonna get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and work out, great, don't do any pre-workout. Don't take your pre-workout and then 4 Adderalls and then have a coffee and come in. We're not gonna do that, right? That's the new thing, right? Adderalls and C4, it's like, if you're 20 years old, 21 years old, Adderall and C4 is how you live your life. And so it is, I'll see 140 beats a minute resting heart rate on a regular basis with all the Adderall use and C4s. So yeah, I mean, it's tough. I've sent people home before. So I make a personal contact with every examinee and I say, leave your phone in the car, park in the right place, wear the right clothes, eat breakfast, take your medications, get a good night's sleep. Do all these things, and if you don't, we are not going to run the test. So it's up to you. I tell them that on the phone. Those are a lot of variables that you can control. How many times you had somebody from a neighboring agency come over to take a test with your agency, and they just got off work. And they just worked all night long.
Yep.
And they came in, and you're like, sorry to waste your time. We're not going to run you today. You've been up for 36 hours. Right?
Thank you.
Right. They've been smoking and doing Zens all night long, and they're on a nicotine high and probably had 5 C4s, and they're taking their Ritalin, Adderall. And so we send them home. We're not gonna do that. We send them home. So those are all variables that you can control. Where to park, leave the phone, smart watch in the car. Tell them on the phone how long it's gonna take, and over-exaggerate it. Don't say it's gonna take us an hour. Say it might take us 4 hours, I don't know. Be ready. Clear your day. And I tell them on the phone, polygraph only takes us about 30 minutes. We got a ton of paperwork to go over, right? So you don't want them thinking they're gonna spend 4 hours sitting in the chair. But tell them they're going to be with you for a few hours. So don't show up and then at 3 o'clock knowing they got to pick their kids up at 4 o'clock. So make sure they're not short on time. Of course, this is all applicants. Take medicines, don't take medicines, whatever it is they need to do. Eat what they wear, thick sweaters, jumpsuits, things that are going to be impossible to test around. Tell them what to wear. All right, ask questions. Make sure that you ask the questions that you need for your agency on the phone so that you can avoid them showing up and in 30 seconds you're handing them a medical waiver saying, oh, you're a type 1 diabetic, you take insulin shots, here's your medical waiver. You're going to need to go to the doctor before you come back and take a test with us, right? Make sure they're not intoxicated. Don't go out the night before drinking. We're in Columbia. We get a lot of Fort Jackson soldiers that are getting out of a drill sergeant academy. They're getting all the way out of the military, getting all the way out of the Army, and they are partying it up on their last. They're on terminal leave, and they'll come showing up after, you know, a three-day bender, ready to take their test. So don't go out drinking the night before. Make sure when you talk to them on the phone, either criminal test or whatever it is, they speak English. Speak English well, you can understand them. All right, well rested, pregnant. I know everybody's got different rules on that. We don't test anybody that's pregnant. I know some people do first trimester. There's lots of different ways to do that, but ask the question. All right, any condition, mental or physical, that may hinder them taking an examination? A lot of these are pre-test questions. Obviously, some of these you can ask on the phone. While you're making their appointments. Any recent surgeries? Any reason why you can't sit in a chair for 30 minutes or so at a time? You can clear up a lot of issues and control a lot of variables. People show up like that, in a cape sweater, with just a bra underneath. There's nothing I can do, right? Not like there's a tank top under there and I can just have them take that off. That was nonsense. And they were told how to show up, told how to dress, right? Have a little bit of a questionnaire that you can ask your examinees. This is pretty standard. I think NCCA has this one. SLED probably uses this one. We use this one. It's just a little questionnaire you would ask in the pretest. Make sure that they're okay, healthy enough to take a test. Some of those you may not want to ask, some you may want to ask. Just depends. Oh, there we go. So, we talked about it earlier. When can you stop a chart?
Before you ask the first
relevant. Anywhere before you get to the first relevant, you can stop a chart that doesn't count against you. You don't count it as a chart. Okay? So, they go irrelevant, sacrifice relevant comparison, and it's just an utter disaster. Stop the chart. Stop it. Figure out what's going on, adjust the pneumos, adjust the cardio, adjust the EDA, get it figured out, give some instructions, start that one over. And tell the examinee, have your examiner tell the examinee, I can only do that once. Put a little pressure on them. I'm only going to do that once. That was your freebie. That was your PTI. We're not going to do that again. Right? Irrelevant, sacrifice, relevant, comparison, and another irrelevant, stop. You're fine. There's no numbers to be put on the charts. You're okay. You hadn't asked irrelevant yet. Irrelevant, sacrifice, relevant, symptomatic comparison, still you can stop if you need to. Once you ask that first relevant, though, you got to score it. So if you decide to go out of operations after that R4, you got to put numbers on R4. We don't have a choice on that. So once you ask R4, you might as well just keep on rocking. You might as well just keep on rocking, right? But you have a lot of options right here before you get to that R4, that first relevant question, to stop the chart and try to fix it. And with new examiners, there's a lot going on inside their brain. Man, it's moving real fast. You're trying to keep all your components and their swim lanes on your charts, on your screen. You're trying to watch the examinee. You're trying to hit the right buttons. You're trying to ask your questions every 20, 25 seconds. You're trying to watch the physiology. It is a lot for a new examiner. It's really easy if you just tell them, look, before you get the first relevant, if it's garbage, just stop. Just stop the chart. All right, if you get that far in on a buy zone, get the R5 and you ask it, you got to score R5. Might as well just keep going. So I would not recommend stopping once you ask your first relevant question. All right. Do something. Have your examiner do something. Try. Silent answer test, move the cardio cuff, adjust the EDA. You got to do something. don't just run three charts of nonsense. And they come out and go, I don't know why these charts suck. Well, they suck because you didn't do anything. You just saw that it was a garbage chart, and you just kept on going for three charts. I like to have the examiner email me each chart. If I'm sitting right outside the room, I leave my email open on the computer. They can just email me each chart after the ACQT, after chart one, after chart two, and maybe I can stop it from getting bad before we get four charts in. So I like to look at each chart as it pops up, if you have that ability to do that. Don't let a new examiner run three terrible charts. Try to jump in there and give some advice. Starts with running and evaluating an ACQT. Does anybody not run an ACQT? Hopefully everybody does. It's a fantastic tool that's going to predict what your charts are going to look like. So I came up with an ACQT worksheet. If anybody would like this, I'd be glad to email it to you. It's good to use with new examiners. Put this right on the back of the score sheet. I know it's hard to see, so I've broken it down in the next couple of slides. You don't have to squint at it. But essentially, you just flip your score sheet over after your ACQT, and you just look at all these things. Was the answer question, did they answer all the questions right? We already know if they answer yes to your key on your ACQT, either you didn't explain it well, or they're messing with you. And they don't want to answer no on the key, right? So it's one of two things. Either it's your fault, because you didn't explain it correctly, or they're messing with you and they're not paying attention. Do they answer too loud, yes or no? Do they need answer instructions, yes or no? Is it 10 breaths a minute? If it's not, how many breaths a minute is it? Poor quality, yes or no? So we'll go through those. This is just the answering section. Did they answer all the questions correctly? Answer too loud, answer instructions needed? Have your new examiner go ahead and fill this out. For the pneumos, how many breaths a minute? Is it poor quality? Is it hyperventilation? Bradypneia? Any breathing instructions given? Were there DBs? Were the pneumos too tight? Do you need to do a countermeasure warning? Or are you going to switch over to silent answer? You make all those decisions during your ACQT, right? And have your new examiner just take 30 seconds to go through that and fill that out. All right, here is a chart. I've got notes on here. This is an ACQT. PNs are nonsense. Cardio's rolling. We switched to silent answer. Made a big difference. Right? Now it's chart one from the ACQT. Cardio's a little better. Pneumos are way better. It becomes a scoreable chart. You go from this, which I would never put numbers on that cardio or the pneumos, to this. Much better. Silent answer, we're just going to have them nod, really easy to an answer. Move their nose up and down, half to a quarter an inch, very easy for a yes, back and forth for a no. Just real easy. And that's a good tool. It's a good tool in our toolbox. Do something. All right, so we have these charts. This is ACQT. This is nonsense. So between ACQT and the chart one, have a conversation. It can be. Or you can just have a conversation with them and it gets a little better. There's probably still some countermeasure issues in there. That cardio is a little wild. But it got a little bit better. Moved to silent answer. Got a little better. Right? EDA is still pretty labile. There's something going on in their brain. All right. EDA, is it erratic? Is it labile? Is the EDA just nonstop? Does the EDA just not stop moving the whole time? Is it labile? A lot of brain activity going on if you have labile EDA. They're singing a song in their head, they're doing math in their head, they're trying to figure out which question they're going to countermeasure to, right? They've been online, they've looked at antipolygraph.org, and they're trying to figure out which is your comparison, which is your relevant, which is your relevant, and they're going to try to attack which one. Inside their brain, they're trying to predict which question you're going to ask next and what they're going to do to attack that question. So labile EDA is always a pretty good indicator of countermeasures. Sticky pads, clean the fingertips, and clean it after ACQT. Always just run the ACQT first because it might be perfect. Don't start out by hitting people's fingertips with the alcohol wipes. Go ahead and run the ACQT and see what it looks like. Then if it doesn't look good, then do it. But it might have been great and then you went and hit it with the alcohol wipes and now it's a mess. So always just run the ACQT kind of as is and see what happens. All right, here's an ACQT where I did just that. Every every time I attach the new the EDA plates, I ask, as I'm putting it on, any medicines, lotions, creams, anything on your fingers? This lady said, I use olive oil for lotion. I said, ooh, these would be good training charts. Let's see what happens. So I put the EDA plates on her, and that's what happens when people use cocoa butter, olive oil, things like that, fresh out of the shower on their hands for moisturizer. And so after the ACQT, I use an alcohol wipe, we do a little better. A little better, right? But always just run the ACQT kind of as it is and just see what happens. Like I said, control all the variables. Control as many variables as you can. Have your new examiner do those things. It's just a version 2 MGQT for screening. All right, getting to the cardio on the ACQT worksheet. Is it rolling? If the cardio is rolling, there's a couple of ways to fix that. What are some of the ways we can fix that?
Remove the cardio cuff.
Cardio cuff, we can move it to the forearm. If they are on the heavy side, that might be the easy thing to do. If the cardio cuff is touching their armpit, their side, maybe put a book, or if your armrest will lift up. I have one of those fancy chairs, the armrest will lift up. You can do that and get the cardio cuff off their arm. Maybe you just need to adjust it. Just take it off, put it back on again. Maybe there's a bunch of sweater or something stuck inside the cardio cuff. There's a lot of ways to adjust that. Is the cardio cuff pushing it against their side? Do they need to move the cardio cuff to the forearm? There's a lot of agencies that start on the forearm. I'm not opposed to that. It's easy, super easy. I have two foam blocks. You put one under the elbow, one under the wrist, and start on the forearm. Most of the time you can use the little small cuff for most people. And it's super easy. You can put more air. You can put 80, 90. You can put the air up to 80 or 90 and they don't even notice because it is so comfortable on the forearm. They don't even notice. Do you need to change the cuff size? If you have a little tiny person and you're using the regular medium size cuff and it'll almost go around the arm twice, you might need to use the little tiny cuff to put it on their arm. Move the arm cuff up into the pit, move it down a little bit. I've had it where I've straightened their arm all the way out before to try to get their cardio right. Do something. Just do something to get it right. But make those decisions, have your examiner make those decisions during the ACQT. That's why it's so important. All right, cardio. Not great. That's cardio doing an ACQT. That was after moving the cardio cuff to the forearm. Didn't have to do anything. Just move the cardio cuff to the forearm. Much better. EDA didn't get much better, but the cardio did. All right. This is for cardio here. Move the cardio cuff to the forearm. Now you're going to have to build a bridge. You can't just put the cardio cuff in the forearm and lay it back down on the armrest. You got to put something under their elbow, under their wrist. The best thing that I've seen is if you go to Walmart and those little small soccer balls that are a little bit bigger than a softball, you just buy two of those and let a little bit of air out of each one, and their elbow will fit right down into it and their hand will fit right onto the other soccer ball. Yeah.
Pool noodles.
Yeah, pool noodles are good.
Just cut the pool noodle into a match your arm.
That's right.
That works real well.
Yep, you can do that.
At sled, we always use two rolls of paper.
Sure.
One on their wrist and one on their elbow.
Elbow, that's right. There's lots of different ways to do that, but you just got to prop the arm up so that it's not sitting on the armrest, because it'll just push on the armrest. All right, cardio pretty flat. This applicant was in fantastic shape, but they're on Lexapro. Cardio pressure was at 63. What would be an option to get some movement out of the cardio? This is ACQT. What would we do to get a little movement out of the cardio?
A little more pressure.
Less pressure.
Less.
Exactly. So there's more room for movement. Yeah. The tighter it is, the harder it is for that heart to push against it to make the movement happen. Does that make sense? Sure. It's almost like it's a harder surface. The tighter the cuff is, the harder it is to push against it. If you let a little pressure out, it'll give room for a little bit more movement, right? So I had it on 63, I moved it down to 50 on this one, and got a little movement out of it. Same thing with blood pressure medicine. Blood pressure medicine, you'll see these perfect cardio that doesn't even move. Let a little pressure out. Let about 10, get it down to about 50, 52, something like that, and you'll see a little bit more movement. It gives more opportunity for movement. The tighter you squeeze it, the less it'll move. like pushing against a harder brick wall. You're almost softening up the cardio cuff a little bit. That makes sense. Nice, perfect pneumos there. All right. New examiners, getting a new examiner to recognize what they have been taught in school by looking at charts is a difficult task because most of the time when they're looking at charts in school, it's like a group thing, right? They hand out some charts, the whole room is looking at kind of the same set of charts, and the instructor doesn't sit down next to each student and say, let's talk about this chart, right? Most of the time it's a group effort. When you sit down with them, and you can go spot by spot, every comparison, every relevant, and sort out whether you're going to put pluses or minuses by it, you may need to do that for 50 or 75 tests straight, and you guys score charts together. Breathing rate's too slow, movements at the cardio, at the comparisons, BBs, countermeasures. A lot of times, a new examiner will just score right all through that stuff. And that's okay. It's okay. It takes time to start picking that stuff up and start looking at it. It's real important that you both sit down after every test and physically go through the whole chart. All right, make notes as you're watching the examination. Review those notes back with the examiner. Make sure that you give them some feedback after every test. It's not just hurry up, run the test, let's go to lunch. Let's go through the things you did well, some things we could do a little bit better on. Make those notes when you're watching your new examiners. All right, all the examinations should be monitored audio video until they're on their own. Don't just be in the building, right? Don't just be available by phone if they need help. And I like to wear noise-canceling headphones, so other people are not distracting me, and I'm pretty focused in watching the video, and I'm really listening to kind of everything they say. Have the ability to step in and correct a mistake if needed. If you just see things are going terribly, it's going way off the rails, they've missed the consent form, they have forgotten to do the ACQT, something has not gone well, have the ability to step in so that you can kind of quickly correct that, knock on the door, say, hey, you got a phone call, can I see you for a second? Get it corrected so they can go back in and fix it. Don't just let them skip whatever the step was that they skipped. Have a predetermined communication way, whether you're going to text or open up Microsoft Teams, or you can hit them on Teams from your computer to theirs, something like that where they can leave a little window open. If your agency has like a little DM program or something where you can like DM with people in patrol cars and they can DM back with you, we have one of those. And you know, kind of leave that window open so that you can at least text them and they can see messages pop up on the laptop or on the computer screen. So you have a way to communicate during the test, if you need to. All right, TDA goals. Your examiner can't be a plus and you're a minus somewhere, right? So if y'all are scoring charts, you could be a minus and a zero or a plus and a zero, but I can't be plus and you can't be minus. We can't be opposites. We're gonna have to come together at the scoring spot. And if it's a TDA rule or a TDA issue, then bust out the TDA manual. That TDA manual that I just taught from is on antipolygraph.org. It is under NCCA TDA. If you just click on there, you can download it, you can print the whole thing out. It's the same thing they teach today. Print that out, put it in a three-ring binder, and leave it on your desk. When there is a disagreement about TDA, go to the book. Page 5, line 4, paragraph 3, this is what it says. Right here. That's what we should do. But we can't be opposites. I can't be a plus and they can't be a minus. They should not copy your score sheets. So if you're scoring right next to them, you gotta do like you did in school and cover your paper up so they're not just looking at what you write and write the same thing. They should have their own scores, they show their own notes, put all their own notes on their own score sheets. If they went solid answer, they do all that, they need to mark all that on their score sheets. Review all the scoring spots together and justify every score. All right. Teaching TDA to new examiners can be tricky for sure. Should be taught by the book, not this is how we do it at our agency. Right? Anytime I hear, well, that's just the way we do it. Well, it's wrong. It should be by some sort of a book. There should be some sort of a book that you go by, whether it's NCCA's TDA book or your TDA book or Lee Baxter's TDA book or somebody's TDA book you have to go by. It can't just be, because none of us in here are scientists or researchers. None of us are participating in huge scientific research on TDA where we can make decisions and say, well, I know better than NCCA does, or I know better than the Polygraph School does. We should have a book on our desk, and this is, it should not be, well, this is just how we do it here. All right. Just talk about that. Yeah, TDA manual. You should have a TDA manual to follow. It shouldn't just be vibes. You should have a TDA manual to follow. And you should know every time I put a number on a score sheet, it is because there's a rule that covers that. Be fully prepared to explain and teach exceptions to homeostasis, cardio, EDA, pneumos. You should be able to explain all of those to your new examiner. You should be able to explain all the TDA rules, or at least have the book there. You should have the rules and scoring techniques. You should be able to teach sudden position and federally assess. If you get a new examiner that comes in and you don't know those things, brush up on it. That way you can intelligently talk about it. Know what the cut scores are. Know what your testing formats are. What rotates, what can't rotate. Can you rotate 5 and 7 in a bi-zone? No. Do you have to rotate the comparisons on a bi-zone? No. Because if the middle comparison is good and it goes to both relevance, you want to be able to leave it there. Right? You don't want to be forced to move that comparison. It says you may rotate comparisons on a bi-zone. Those are little things you have to be able to know and know why. All right. Recognize atypical physiology, countermeasures. That'll be hard to do. It'll take a while for a new examiner to do that. Component placement. You would think that, you know, when they come out of polygraph school, they've just got it. It's easy. Just throw components on. Believe it or not, that's harder for some people than it is for others. You have to practice that stuff. Especially if it's a male examiner putting components on a female. You may have to just practice that and make sure that they have a way that they do it where they're not molesting the examinee and they are also putting it on accurately and as they should. So you may have to sit in the chair and have people come in that might be larger or larger chested or something like that and have them practice putting on components. Have them practice putting on the top pneumos so that they're not, you know, just tuning in Tokyo up there or something, right? So you need to make sure that that is all talked about. Don't just leave it to chance. Don't just say, okay, it's your first test, go at it, have at it. Let's talk about how to put components on, right? Pre-test, post-test procedures. Talk about how long that should take. How long should a pre-test take? It takes as long as it takes, right? Pre-test just takes as long as it takes. Don't get worried about, I've been in there for 2 hours going over the booklet. Well, it just took 2 hours. That's just how long it took. But on a post-test, it should be 5 minutes on an SR. We need to go a little longer than that. This is not exhaustive. There's a lot of other things you have to go over with a new examiner, but these are some good go-bys when you're training new people. All right, is it your job to train a new polygraph examiner on interview interrogation? Ooh, that's hard. It's hard enough to teach polygraph. It's even harder to teach polygraph and interview interrogation. That's why picking somebody off the road to go to polygraph school may be difficult. It may be hard to teach somebody who's never sat in a room and interrogated somebody how to interrogate somebody post-test. It's not easy. Get them signed up for interview interrogation classes. I teach one. Brian teaches one. There's plenty available across the state that are probably free or low cost. And get them in some interview interrogation so that they can start learning how to talk to people post-test, really, and pre-test. All right. Are we going to interrogate a post-test applicant the same as we interrogate a post-test suspect? No. Post-test applicant might be your supervisor one day. So they'll remember how you treated them. Post-test. If you roll your chair around and get knee-to-knee, there's no doubt in my mind. You lied on this test today. And then they don't give up anything and they get hired. And 5 years down the road, they're your sergeant. And I remember you. You get to work night shift for the rest of your life, right? So we're definitely going to treat applicants a little different than we treat suspects on post-test. Mid-stern, low-stern, right? We're not going to stand up over the top of them, point at them, you lied. Take it easy on them. How do we do a proper NSR on an applicant post-test for comparison test, for a PLC? What do we always have to do on every PLC test if it's an NDI or an NSR? You have to make sure they know you saw them lie to the PLC. We don't just walk up to somebody after they went NDI on a buy zone, on a CSC, and go, all right, man, you're good, you passed, get on out. They just lied. They just lied to three of your comparisons, at least three times each. So you got to say, hey, man, I saw a little thing, a little trouble there with that question that related to lying to your friends and family. What were you thinking about there? Well, I thought about one time when I lied to my mom. Well, that's probably what it was. That's probably what it was. All right, shouldn't cause you too much trouble in the test today. Just want to let you know I saw a little trouble with that question related to lying to your friends and family or lying to your supervisor or whatever it is. Have a nice day. We'll be back in touch with you. If you just walk in the door on a buy zone, on a CSC, and you say, yep, you're good, get out. You got to tell them you saw them lie to the comparison, right? Polygraph school teaches that. Hopefully they're still teaching that. You learned that? Yes. On a PLC, you have to do that. That's old school. It's been taught forever. On a DLC, we don't have to do that, right? Because the gig is up. They know you lied. They know they lied. You know they lied. We're not going to sit there and say, I saw you lie about that traffic question.
His big thing was, hey, you need to get this cleared up if you have to take polygraph.
That's right. That's the way they teach it. If you ever have another polygraph again, make sure we know about you had a little trouble in this friends and family question.
So you don't give them their results at the end of their exam.
QC. Goes for QC. I say, doesn't look like you have had too much trouble on test today. Just saw a little something there with your honesty and integrity question, whichever PLC it was. And say, we'll be in touch. Because everything goes for QC. Last thing I want to do is say, hey man, everything looks fine. Because I don't have in-house QC. It's going to take a day or two for my QC to come back. And I send them on their way and I say, yeah, you passed. And then QC comes back and said, man, you did your math wrong. This guy's DISR. I got to call him back on the phone and say, I know I told you you passed. But just kidding. You failed. You got to come in for another test. If it's an applicant, right? If they failed, they know they failed because we're going to go knee to knee and have a conversation, right? So, but no, I don't tell them right there on the spot. And I tell them, it goes for QC, we'll let you know. But I don't see anything that's going to cause you too much trouble on the test today. So I kind of tell them between the lines without telling them, if that makes sense. On a comparison test. R&I, you can just call it whatever you want to call it. Just, I want to hurry up and eat lunch, so you pass. So, acceptable post-test for criminal versus criminal-specific DI and DI. Are we going to break it out? So if we have an applicant that we're going to break out the test, or no opinion, or an SR, we get a little minor admission from them, we're going to break it out, do it right then. If you don't lose rapport, then you can just roll right into another little series. If you got their behind pretty good and got a little tear to come out, a little snot bubble, then they're probably not going to be a good retest, right? Probably just move on and bring them back another day. Especially in today's climate, HR wants probably another test. So take it easy. If you already have it built into your brain that you're going to break them out, nothing wrong with going at them for a little while, 20 minutes or so. See if you can get something from your applicant, but don't go too hard. We talked about that. If your new examiner is struggling with their post-test NDI or post-test NSR, and if they're just going on and on and on, and they're trying to get a comparison confession from the person in the chair, and the person just won't give a confession to the comparison material. Does that make sense? Like, they're not coming off of lying to their friends or family, or they're not coming off of lying, you know, cheating in school, whatever your comparisons are. And they're just not coming off of it, then just pick one. Have them just pick one and say, I saw some trouble in that question. I saw some trouble in the question related to you cheating in school. No, you didn't. I never cheated in school. Well, I'm just telling you what I saw. I saw that you had a little trouble with that question. Hopefully it won't cause you too much trouble. Maybe you're just thinking back to a time like in elementary school, you looked at your neighbor's paper or something like that. That's probably what triggered that response there. Just pick a PLC. Just have your examiner pick a PLC, tell them they saw the response, and then get them out. You shouldn't go on for 5 minutes arguing about getting a confession to a PLC. Does that make sense? Sometimes I had new examiners do that before. But you also always want to make sure, criminal test, applicant test, that you saw them lie to the PLC. We don't just walk them out. You don't just say, hey man, you passed, get up. All right, when examiners start thinking on the fly, making rational decisions based on their education, based on their training, they're starting to make progress, right? When they email you the chart, after they email you your ACQT, and you're looking at it, and you're going, all right, this ACQT needs, you need to move the cardio, you need to go to silent answer, and then they text you and say, hey, I'm gonna move the cardio and I'm gonna go to silent answer. You're like, huh, here we go, all right? You're starting to make your own decisions, starting to look better. I didn't have to tell you what to do. You're starting to make good decisions. You're starting to recognize what good charts look like. They're making progress. New examiners are kind of on autopilot. And whatever you tell them to do, they'll kind of do that thing, even if you need to adjust it later. You don't know why they're doing it. They just know they need to do it. I had a new examiner one time that got stuck on doing an applicant. They got stuck on the booklet on the driving section because this applicant had like 5 warning tickets. And my new trainee examiner was going in on these warning tickets. Like, when was this warning ticket? And who wrote it? And I was like, I knocked on the door. I was like, let's keep going. Let's don't spend 15 minutes on warning tickets. Well, you told me to get everything. I said, I did. But you need to be able to use some common sense and spend time on the things that are important. Now, if you got some warning tickets for not wearing your seatbelt or speeding a little bit and didn't turn into an actual ticket, let's move on. Let's move on from it. Like, don't spend a ton of time on it. So sometimes they'll just go through the motions and they don't exactly know what they're doing. You have to kind of explain that to them a little bit. What's important, what's not important. All right, we have to be able to recognize when they're ready. I know state law here in South Carolina says 150, but they may not be ready at 150. That 150th test may not be great. You might need to say, look, we need 10 more, we need 15 more, we need 20 more. We can't cut it shorter than 150 unless they're a federal examiner and they're trying to bypass the 150 rule. But when we talk about how many they need, it's really going to be up to you. 150 may not be enough, and that's okay. That's okay. It's not going to be the same for everybody. New examiners can only absorb so much instruction at once, right? 2-3 things. Anybody here work football games at the University of South Carolina? When they teach us to give people instructions, what do they say? You give them 3 instructions. You go to this place and turn left, you go to that place and turn right, and then it'll be down on your right. You don't say, you go up here to Bluff Road, and then when you see the cockaboose, you turn there, you walk about 100 yards, and you go by the corn dog place, and you turn right there. You give them 3 instructions to get to their seats. That's kind of what we need to be doing with new examiners. Every time they run the chart, whatever they didn't do well the day before, let's pick 3 of those things and say, today, here's what we're going to concentrate on. Chart markings, quality charts, and good ACQT. Right, those are going to be things we did not do as well yesterday that I would have liked for us to have done. So let's pick those 3 things. Let's concentrate on those today. And when they do that well, then the next time we're going to pick 2 or 3 more things, and we're going to get those dialed in a little bit better. And each day we'll dial those things in a little better and a little better. Can't throw everything at them at once. Gradually increase more and more instruction over time. 100 to 155 supervised tests may be reasonable. Obviously, I teach this in other states, so... Now that sounds kind of redundant. 12-month supervised testing, watching, listening on CCTV. What does supervised mean? Not necessarily scrolling on your phone or just being in the building, like listening to them, watching them run the test. Talk about this, consider creating a training program. Should apply to new examiners out of school and certified examiners hired from other agencies. So just because they were certified somewhere else, I know agencies, chiefs and sheriffs are like, this guy is certified out of Louisiana. Okay. Let's see what that looks like when he comes in here and runs a few charts. I don't know what certified out of Louisiana or New York or Chicago or wherever they're from. We don't know what that's going to look like. So even though they're certified from somewhere else, you're not just going to stick them into a room and say, here, have at it. You don't need any input. There's some federal examiners out there that are retired that are doing some wacky stuff. Just because they work for the FBI or the Secret Service doesn't mean they're automatically going to be great examiners following the rules. So we need to watch everybody. All right, certified examiners a lot of times can move through the program on an accelerated level if they meet standards. I know there's some ways that they can run less than 150 tests in South Carolina if they meet standards, if they're certified from somewhere else like a federal examiner or something like that. All right, I went through that really fast, try to get us out of here. Any questions? Training new examiners is a lot. It's a lot. If you take it seriously, you'll be exhausted at the end of every day, right? You really pour a lot into getting your person trained, especially if they're going all over the place. And you get them like, you know, every so often. They'll run tests in 3 or 4 other places and they come to you. And they run tests in 3 or 4 other places and they come to you. Sometimes what other people tell them to do are way different than maybe what you're doing. So that can be difficult. I know maybe things down in Charleston, Low Country, might be slightly different than the way we do things in Columbia, or in Greenville might be slightly different, the way we run chests or the way that we do TDA. Hopefully, the TDA we talked about is kind of pretty close to what we're all doing anyway. And that if I send you a test, it shouldn't look like Greek. If you send me one of your tests, I should be able to recognize it, know what it is, and be able to score it out. We should hopefully be pretty close on the scores. All right, well, I appreciate the time. It's always a privilege and a pleasure to talk to you guys. Sometimes I feel silly up here, like you guys have more experience than I do in polygraph. And here I am talking to you guys about things that I've been doing half as long as y'all been doing it. So if you have any questions, I'm going to leave my card up here. Please, if you're interested in PLEE, let me know. Get my card, send me an email, send me a text. We'd love to have you on. We'd love to be able to send you all over the country and do some teaching if you're interested in that. We'll start you slow, start you easy, and kind of gradually get you into it. If you're interested in PLEE but you don't want to teach, that's okay too. That's fine. That way we can get you set up with a QC, or you can be a QC for somebody else. We always have a lot of one-man shops that need help with QC, like me. My guy from Tennessee Bureau of Investigations is going to retire here soon, and we'll have to get somebody else. So, any questions, concerns, comments? All right, appreciate it.
Good job.
Thank you.